So my guess is that even if it weren't Transfiguration Sunday, many of us would have mountains on the brain this week. How many of you have been watching, tuning into the early days of the Olympics? Anybody? It is one of my favorite times of year to see all these amazing, spectacular feats. We had dinner with some friends last night, and my friend was saying he doesn't watch many sports these days, but he always so gets into the Olympics. So even for people who are casual sports fans, there's something about the Olympics and something about these majestic mountains we've been seeing and the crazy thing that people do on these mountains, right? So we see these, we see them do things like that. Now, I have never skied like that in my life, nor do I care to. But it's just amazing to see the speed and the agility and the fearlessness of the competitors that come down the mountains. Or the snowboarders. Anyone watch the snowboarders last night? I found myself thinking, oh my gosh, could you imagine having been one of their moms? Like watching those reckless daredevil kids grow up doing all kinds of stunts, you know, the first time that they do a 360, then a 720, and then a 1080, just crazy. How do you gain the courage to do that, and how, as a mom, do you not look away every time? And, of course, we've been seeing plenty of Lindsey Vonn, one of the faces of this Olympics, coming back from injury and one of the American hopefuls for medals this year. And this was the cover of the Washington Post on Friday morning. And I love this freeze frame version of Adam Rippon, one of the men's figure skaters in the U.S. team. And I love how it took this, we see them do those jumps, right? And they spin so fast. And I love how it took it and it just broke it down frame by frame by frame. Or this image of those snowboarders coming off those hills and making those turns and twists in the air. Pretty amazing. And then they capture it freeze frame like that. All of this had me thinking about Peter up on the mountain with Jesus, because Jesus has taken some of his closest disciples up there, Peter, James, and John. They go up on a mountain, and any time that something happens on a mountain in the Bible, you ought to pay attention. Important things happen on the mountains, right? The giving of the law, Sermon on the Mount. And so, and the Transfiguration is one of those stories. It's in a holy place. And so we are set for something exciting to happen. And what Peter wants to happen there, as Jesus is suddenly flanked by Moses and Elijah, and Jesus is radiating white. It's as if though his garments were bleached whiter than anyone could ever bleach them. So here you have Jesus radiating light in the center. On one side, the symbol of the law. On the other side, the symbol of the prophets. And here you have Jesus right in the middle, the fulfillment of both. This is a holy moment, and Peter knows it. Peter's impulses are always pretty on target, but they are also a little off target, right? And so Peter is the one who speaks up right away and says, Lord, it's good that we are with you. We should build you three booths. So that we can capture, freeze frame this moment. I was saying to the 9:30 service, I called my sermon intentionally a Kodak moment, and I realized I would have to explain it to half of the people at the 9:30 service. They don't know what a Kodak moment. How many? You know what a Kodak moment is, right? A Kodak moment when you pull out your camera and you want to capture that moment, whether it's your child's first step, or whether it's a graduation, or whether it's a holy moment with friends, and you just want to capture that. Now we just pull out our phones to do that. If Peter had a camera, he would have pulled out the camera. If Peter were a 21st century follower of Jesus, he might have pulled out his cell phone and taken a selfie with himself in front and Jesus and Moses and Elijah in the background. I sort of picture Peter doing that kind of thing. So I went looking for a picture like that. I wondered if somebody had imaginatively come up with that scene from the Transfiguration. I couldn't find that, but I did find this. Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus. And then when the circle expands, the wise men coming and taking a selfie with the shepherds in the back. And there's the Holy Family. But I still haven't found the one with Peter in front of Jesus and Moses and Elijah, and that is your assignment this week. If you can find me that picture, I bet you it's out there somewhere. Bring it to me or send it to me. So what's happening up on the mountain? I think there's some really important stuff happening. It's looking back, it's looking forward, and it's looking downward. The looking backward, I think Peter may be onto something. One biblical scholar was suggesting that this is an allusion back to Numbers 11 when Moses is gathering the 70 elders around the tent of meeting. And so his inclination to want to build booths, tents which symbolize the presence of God, is really not that far off. He knew that he was on holy ground with Jesus and with Moses and Elijah, and he wanted to memorialize. He wanted to put a monument up there. But this is a fleeting kind of thing. It doesn't last long. As quickly as they come on the scene, they're gone. It's a look back in another way, too. If you have been in worship with us over the last month and a half, you ought to recognize the words that you heard pronounced about Jesus in this moment, right? Did they sound familiar? What did they sound like? They sounded like the words from Jesus' baptism, right? This is my beloved Son. And to those words are added this little phrase at the end, listen to him, pay attention to him, honor him. And then the moment passes. And so there's this look back in the transfiguration. Just like Jesus' baptism was a time of claiming his identity for Jesus, now it's a time for the disciples to know Jesus' identity, to see him framed by the law and the prophets, and to understand his place in the story of salvation. So it's a look back. It's also a look ahead. It's this glimpse into the future as well. The thing that Jesus has been talking about right before going up onto the mountain with the disciples is his upcoming suffering and being turned over to the authorities. He's starting to talk about his death and the passion. And the thing he's going to talk about next, when they go down from the mountain, he's going to talk about that same thing again. And so up on the mountain, it is a glimpse forward to what is coming as well. Not only his suffering and his death, but also a hint at the resurrection. When you see Jesus in his glory radiating like white, like snow, it ought to bring Easter images to mind. The resurrected Jesus. So it's a look back and it's a look forward. So anchoring Jesus both in the past and just a little preview of what is to come once Jesus gets on the other side of the suffering and the death, there will be glory again. But I want to suggest that it's also an important part of this whole story is the movement downward that happens right after verse 9. Because Jesus doesn't linger on that mountain for long. Jesus doesn't stay there and say, look at me, look at me, look at me. As much as we would like to stay on the spiritual mountaintops in our lives, as much as we would like to hold on to those holy moments with God, whether it be at a retreat or a work camp or a volunteer's mission trip or just a private time that you have with God or the moment when you were a teenager and you said yes to God for the first time, as much as we want to hold on to those moments, we know that most of our spiritual lives are not lived on the mountaintop. Nor did Jesus spend most of his time on the mountaintop, which for us ought to be good news. Because for most of us who live in the valley for much of the time, it's good to know that Jesus, immediately after this moment of revelation, this epiphany moment, we're ending the season of epiphany, he heads back down the mountain. And in verse 17, after they've spent some time talking about Elijah, the next thing that comes Jesus' way is a request from a man, won't you come heal my son? Teacher, I brought you my son. He needs your healing. And so Jesus is immersed back again in the thing that he's doing most of all, which is hanging out with people who find themselves in the valley. Jesus is with people offering hope, offering healing, offering a glimpse of the kingdom of God, inviting people into that relationship with God. Jesus is hanging out in the valley. Jesus spends most of his ministry, in fact, with people in the valley, and I am grateful for that. Now, on Tuesday night, I was sitting here in this section along with our youth. It was our beginning ASP meeting, the first Appalachia Service Project meeting. And it's always a really exciting time because you've got teenagers coming back to that meeting who have been on ASP once or twice or four times or five times. Tommy, you remember what that's like, right? When you get, you're started gearing up for the new year. And there are adult leaders who have been many times over, but there are also the first-timers who are sitting in that group. And they're starting to get excited about what ASP might be about, like Kylie, right? Kylie getting to anticipate what it might be like for me to be part of that this year. And they do a wonderful job. Lee explains some of the logistics, but it's also a time when they Ray Gushy will show a slideshow of what it's like to be part of ASP, and it is a feel-good moment. It's a holy, sacred time. Tommy's nodding his head. He knows that well. You've sat there many times, haven't you? And so there I was sitting there enjoying this moment, this energy in the sanctuary on Tuesday night when somebody told me there were a couple people out in the lobby looking for a meeting, and I went out to meet them. They were three young adults, Chris and Deanna and Daniel, and they had come here looking for a suicide support group that used to happen about 5 or 6 years ago, so it hasn't happened here for a long time, but it's still out there on some website, not ours, but some website said it met here on Tuesday nights. And I started talking to them, and I found out that Chris had just lost his girlfriend the week before to a suicide. And Deanna was a good friend, and they were here to support Chris, but they were also here for themselves. And so I went in the office, and I started looking up to see if maybe it was meeting somewhere else, and if I could find them resources. I found them a group that does meet this Tuesday night. It's in Severna Park. And then I said to them, you know, I'm here, and you came wanting to talk tonight. I said, why don't we go back to my office, and we'll just talk. And you can tell me the story. And so we went back to my office. This meeting went on here, still in the sanctuary. And we talked for the next 90 minutes about this young woman's life, her very troubled, hard life. She had battled depression for a lot of years. She was paranoid. She had fought her demons hard. She had tried to take her life several times and then finally succeeded. And they were dealing with all of those feelings that you deal with after that. You deal with second-guessing and guilt and wondering if I could have done anything and all of those things. And we sat and we talked and we cried and we prayed. And, you know, I felt Jesus no less in my office than I had in the sanctuary earlier in the evening, because Jesus is always hanging out in the valleys, always goes down from the mountaintop to meet us where we are in our pain and brokenness. And so it was the next day on Thursday that I was in the office, and we were doing lots of things. There's lots of energy and things going on this week. It's a busy week. And got a call from Tracy Prettyman that the hospice nurse said maybe her mom had just a few more hours to live. So I wrapped up what I was doing, and I got in the car, and I went over to be with Tracy and with Ed and Brianna and Ben, her fiance. And by the time I got there, Colette had already died, just died. But the nurse was there, the chaplain had been there earlier that afternoon, and they were okay. They were at a peaceful moment of letting her mom go. She said, you know, my mom was almost 91 years old, and all but the last 10 days of her life, she lived fully, joyfully. And we talked about those stories, and I learned more about her life. I learned this great story about her life, how she had just seen a movie recently, The Greatest Showman. Have any of you seen that movie? And she asked Brianna, her granddaughter, she said, who's that really good-looking guy in the movie? And she said, you mean Hugh Jackman? She said, no, the young one, Zac Efron. She has decided that Zac Efron had displaced Dean Martin on her list of celebrity crushes, which I love that about. Just recently, this is a woman that was so full of life, and they were so grateful for her life, and we were able to pray and be together and experience Christ in our midst, to see that Jesus was in the valley, even as you let go of someone that you love a lot. Now, this week, as many of you have been involved with Winter Relief. How many of you have been part of Winter Relief this week? It's a church-wide effort. It takes hundreds of folks to make this happen under incredible leadership. And I'm always touched when I see all of you volunteering and coming at all times of the day, and kids showing up and so joyfully serving, and moms and their kids serving together, and the people who show up to do the breakfast crew. I mean, it's one thing to come up here and do a dinner, but Carol Parker, you're part of that breakfast crew. What time do you have to get here in the morning? 5 a.m., right? And so it's an act of love and hospitality to come at 5 a.m. so that you can provide a warm, good breakfast as we're sending our guests out every day. I think I saw Sue Spath like every day for breakfast. And Carolyn and Pam run such an amazing ship here. It takes so many, there are so many moving parts and so many volunteers to coordinate and so many pieces to this. And they do it with such joy and with such grit and with such faith. And all the meals that get prepared in that kitchen, caloric love that is poured out. Our choir was there on Thursday night working together. But it's the relationships that matter. It's the conversations around the table that always move me. It's these intersections of our lives that are a glimpse forward of what the kingdom of God is like, I'm convinced. And when I see our guests and look into their eyes and into their faces, I see the determination. I see the hardship that they have come through. I see the love and the tenderness that they have for each other and the way they support each other and carry each other. The way so many of them are working hard. This is Robert, who was going for a job interview this week, and it went well, and he thinks he might get the job if he can figure out the transportation thing. The deep friendships that form. And this is my new friend Jeff, who told me that no one had taken his picture alone in the last 24 years. And so I had got to share that sacred moment with him, of just him in the frame. I've been reading, I posted something on Facebook a couple weeks ago about Father Gregory Boyle's new book, Barking to the Choir. Barking to the Choir. He has all these wonderful malaprops that his clients and friends from Homeboy Industries give, and they always turn the phrase slightly differently. So that's where that comes from, Barking to the Choir. And Gregory Boyle has been working with people who have lived in like unimaginable circumstances. These are people who have been abused and abandoned and fought through raising themselves as 7-year-olds or 10-year-olds, and they end up in gangs. And it's not surprising, given some of the stories that they've been through. But Father Gregory Boyle looks at them with the compassion and the eyes of Christ. And he's always writing about how he doesn't see that the church's mission is just to go bring Christ to them, but the church's mission is to look for Christ in them and to see where Jesus is already present. And he's always convicting me with his words and his stories. And in one chapter this week, he has this chapter on awe and wonder. And he's referencing how awe and wonder fell over the early church in the book of Acts. And this whole chapter is about moments of awe and wonder, just like the transfiguration is this moment of awe and wonder. And he says, we will be judged in our communities, the strength of our communities, by our ability to stand in awe of what folks have to carry rather than in judgment at how they carry it. If we can be in awe of how much they have to carry. Awe is the great leveler. Kinship asks us to move from blame to understanding. When we see each other with the eyes of Christ, when we see Christ's eyes looking back at us, then there is a level playing field. And we know that I have a burden and you have a burden too. We may come from different worlds, different lives. Some of us might have houses now and some of us might not. But we all belong to God. And Jesus walks in the valley beside each and every one of us. The Transfiguration is a holy moment. I love the fact that we get a clear picture of who Jesus is in this moment. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. Jesus flanked by Moses and Elijah. But I'm so glad that Jesus goes down that mountain. And I came across this other picture this week that if Jesus were taking the picture, Jesus were taking the selfie, this is what it looks like when Jesus takes the selfie. You see, Jesus is never in the middle of the frame. When Jesus takes the selfie, the picture of himself, suddenly it looks like all of us. And I think the challenge of discipleship is to look at the world that way. To look for the face of God in our brothers and sisters, whether it's for a week or a lifetime. And to know that we have a Jesus who travels with us every day. Not just on the mountaintop, but in the valley. Thanks be to God. Amen.